gates of the CIA front and back if they brought him to trial. Many of the prominent people who could have linked Ed Wilson and his activities to a continuing relationship with the CIA turned up dead. We've been looking at the various high-level connections of Ed Wilson to people still prominent and involved in the CIA, including Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, and his connections to people like Strom Thurmond, or allegations of connections to people like Strom Thurmond and others, and his various cases that he was involved in. Perhaps we can start to begin to at least look at why they might indeed still be connected to the intelligence community.
Okay, now several things in that passage are worth taking note of before we move on, because we have a lot of other information from this gung-ho article. First of all, take note of the fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee, which are the, I believe it was the House, Congressional Investigators. We've referred several times to congressional investigations of the Turple Wilson case, and it doesn't say which House. The gung-ho article doesn't say J. David Truby, doesn't say which House investigation was involved with, but he says basically that that a CIA insider controlled the course of the congressional investigation of Turple and Wilson so that they basically wouldn't find anything. Take note of the fact that, as Truby says, Theodore Shackley, who was very much involved with Turple and with Edwin Wilson in the Bay of Pigs, that Theodore Shackley admits to having used Turple and Wilson as an intelligence source after they supposedly left the agency. Take note of the fact that Theodore Shackley, after his own retirement, went to work for some corporate fronts which were set up and funded by Edwin Wilson. Take note also of the fact that the association between Thomas Kleins and Theodore Shackley, because Thomas Kleins, again, was the number one in the CIA's clandestine services, whereas Truby refers to Shackley as the number two, and both of them are very much involved with Turple and Wilson in the corporate fronts that they used for, among other things, their Libyan operation. Okay, very, very important thing to take note of. And also note the fact that apparently, according to Truby, Frank Turple must have continued to operate with CIA when he was involved with his arms business. And, of course, the passage which Nip Tuck just noted for you there, that the Turple Wilson team operated, as do other CIA teams, in countries which have shaky diplomatic relations with the United States. Okay, there may be other possible motivations for the Turple Wilson Gaddafi Association and so forth. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But take note of the fact that, again, apparently one of the congressional committees investigating the Turple Wilson thing was Deep Six. Basically, its investigation was Deep Sixed by a CIA insider in charge. And again, the Shackley-Kleins-Wilson association can't be overemphasized. That Shackley, number two guy in the CIA's clandestine services, close to Wilson, goes to work for corporate fronts set up by Wilson after his formal retirement, that is, after Shackley's retirement for CIA. His association with Thomas Kleins in those fronts, the Kleins-Wilson Association we've talked about before. So, again, the director and deputy director of covert operations for the CIA involved in the same melange of corporate fronts that Wilson and Turple use for funding Libya. And, again, using them by their own admission for a quote, back-channel intelligence source. Okay, going back to the article from Gung Ho, June of 1982, by J. David Truby, called High Stakes Mercs. And here Truby quotes Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, who we spoke about earlier. He was a former Air Force focal point officer handling liaison between Pentagon and CIA for all CIA operations involving air units. Truby writes as follows here, quoting Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty: "Nobody fights anywhere today without someone in Washington saying okay," says retired Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, a former CIA Pentagon liaison officer who was directly in control of setting up scores of U.S.-backed mercenary actions in the Middle East and the Caribbean. "American mercenaries don't freelance anymore, and they don't just successfully pick up and go fight anymore either. American foreign policy will not risk that embarrassment. Today's mercs are all government-issue professionals, all bearing the prime stamp of the CIA and usually the Army Special Forces or Navy SEALs. If Uncle Sam doesn't want you to go soldiering on your own somewhere, you'll never get there or back, one way or the other. Either the customs FBI or CIA will stop you, or somebody over there will get you with Uncle Sam's blessings. Prouty adds, you have to have that license issued in Washington by way of Langley to be a mercenary. Prouty says with strong emphasis that there are simply no independent high-stakes mercenaries anymore. None of the so-called executive-level mercs is on his own. All of them. Every single one has U.S. government sponsorship or he wouldn't be working. Some of them may actually be retired from the CIA, the military, or other agencies, that's true. And some may actually be in business for themselves. But each and every one of them works within the active support of the U.S. government. Still later, Truby goes back to quoting Theodore Shackley, again, former number two man at CIA covert operations, a business partner with the number one man, a former number one man, Thomas Kleins, and also very much involved with Edwin Wilson, again, retiring to work for some of the companies set up by Edwin Wilson. Truby writes as follows in High Stakes Mercs. When you get down to the bottom of the line basics, the problem is really simple. There are more people demanding more of a share of a rapidly lessening supply of natural resources. Theodore Shackley notes, political ideologies will be meaningless. Vanishing raw materials coupled with increasing population and social, economic, and political upheavals will add to world instability. The Soviet challenge is simple. Exclude the West from these materials. The world is rapidly running out of oil. Both East and West want it for themselves. The world is growing rapidly more hungry, and there are many more mouths to feed, yet each year, less and less food is raised. The potential conflict over food and energy is coming to a hard, rolling boil very soon. Now do you see why it's vital that America keep these unstable areas on our side? Shackley asks. We must keep the Middle East in the Western camp. It's pure, simple survival. We need that oil. But while we're willing to share it, the Russians are not. It's the same with food, water, and other natural resources. End quote. That's why the CIA... Now, this is not a quote here. This is Truby summing up what he feels Shackley has just said. That's why the CIA has men like Turpel and Wilson actively operating in these Middle East countries using such deep covers as they have. There are perhaps a dozen other American mercs operating in the Middle East in the same fashion. It's our national security insurance policy out there, many insiders claim. So here, basically, Shackley and Truby are, Truby the author of the article, Shackley, partner of Wilson and Thomas Kleins, and again, former number two man for covert operations for CIA, they're basically saying that the Turpel Wilson operation in Libya was indeed a CIA operation, and they attribute the causes for this to the fact that it is important to sort of babysit Gaddafi for the United States so that we can get the Middle Eastern oil. But here is a flat statement that that operation was CIA, that it was from the heart of the national security establishment. But they attribute this to the necessity to maintain access to Middle Eastern oil. Now, we'll evaluate other possibilities for that motivation a little later in the broadcast. But again, keep in mind Fletcher Prouty's statement that no high-level mercenaries operate anywhere independently anymore, and Shackley's account of Turpel and Wilson as babysitting Gaddafi in order to get Libyan oil.
One of the things that, in light of what Fletcher Prouty said, that we unfortunately did not have time to cover tonight were a variety of articles that appeared before Ed Wilson was arrested and brought to trial. When the Turpel and Wilson thing first hit the news, about all of the variety of times that huge shipments of weaponry and weapons-related technology were intercepted by customs people going out of the country, and that high-level calls to Washington brought orders to lay off, to let them go, et cetera, et cetera. And there were several different testimonies to this effect that came out in newspaper articles. So bearing in mind what Fletcher Prouty said, you can apply that logic to the situation and see if it doesn't ring true. Okay, skipping along in the same article, this starts off with a quote from Ed Charles, who is, I believe, an ex-intelligence agent himself, and he says as follows, quote, that's the major reason, again, what they're talking about earlier, having control or at least contact with these shaky diplomatic areas. quote, "That's the major reason behind the deep cover for Wilson and Turple, deniability. They are painted as defectors to Libya, taking all sorts of sophisticated gear with them. Get serious. How could they smuggle all that bulky technological material and those tons of explosives out of the U.S. and into Libya unless the State Department and the CIA wanted them and it there? There's no way. The company puts out the cover story that the guys are renegades who just happened to recruit some, quote, former Green Berets and some, quote, former Air Force technicians to go to Libya and help Gaddafi. All those people are over there with a full blessing and knowledge of Mr. Reagan's CIA. They're babysitting Gaddafi to protect Gulf Oil's investments, which, of course, are parallel to American interests," Charles notes.
Okay, so there, a reiteration of the CIA stamp on Turple and Wilson by another former CIA agent, a man named Ed Charles. Next, Truby goes back to Colonel Fletcher Prouty, former Air Force focal point officer again, and Prouty goes on at some length about the Turple Wilson operation, and apparently Turple and Wilson operated in some areas that Prouty himself was familiar with, again from Gung Ho, June of 82. Consider the raw oil from Libya and the Gulf Oil Corporation, for example. According to both Ed Charles and Colonel Fletcher Prouty, the CIA considers Gaddafi an asset, however bizarre he may be. I'm going to repeat that sentence again because we're going to be getting into this in just a second. According to both Ed Charles and Colonel Fletcher Prouty, the CIA considers Gaddafi an asset, however bizarre he may be. That's why there is a Turple Wilson operation between Lebanon and Tripoli, to babysit the Gaddafi regime on behalf of the U.S. and Gulf Oil. Gaddafi is Gulf Oil's unwanted main man there, desirable or not. It's a quid pro quo situation. Gulf gets the Libyan oil, and Gaddafi gets rich. That's not an especially unique arrangement, Prouty says. It's this arrangement that allows hundreds of tons of strategic material to go from American supply bases in both the U.S. and England to Libya, all of it bound for Gaddafi via his friends Wilson and Turple. Some 20 tons of C4 explosive were shipped to Libya, along with 300,000 delay timers, dozens of laser night vision surveillance cameras and rifle scopes, all standard and current CIA issue, some of it the very latest technology. According to Prouty, much of the hardware was supplied from England because Cheddington, located north of London, is a large CIA staging area and base for the Middle East. He says, "Cheddington is the major CIA supply point for weapons and other equipment. We maintain huge storage and shop facilities there to supply sanitized equipment through our regular agents and their so-called mercenaries. There are also literally hundreds of tons of weapons stored there that were captured during the various Israeli-Egyptian wars, plus Soviet ordnance taken in Africa, Asia, etc." Prouty says most of the supplies that went to Libya were delivered to a U.S. secret base near Tripoli. He recalls, "We bought the base outright from their government in 1944, and I understand that not only does the U.S. still own that base, but that it is a very active CIA operation. That's where the Turple Wilson stuff was brought in, and that's how it got there safely. I worked in that area myself, and I know what's there. Let's be realistic. You can't operate at that plateau, in that area, with those tonnages, and with that level of sophisticated equipment without official U.S. sanction," Prouty points out. "Nobody just obtains a fleet of cargo 747s of the latest technology and hardware on his own and has the means to get it all to Libya. For decades now, American media, politicians, and military brass have loudly blamed the Soviets for exporting the means and personnel of warfare to unstable lands. All the while, we're trying our own national damnedest not to be second best in the very same business." So, again, Prouty noting here that Turple and Wilson's operation was indeed CIA, and interestingly enough, that apparently their material was brought to a base in Libya. He says a base near Tripoli, which apparently belongs to the United States government, and which is an active CIA operation to this day, according to Prouty. So, despite the hostility, at least apparent hostility, between the United States and Gaddafi, we still have a very large and active CIA base in Libya. And again, noting this last sentence here, last couple of sentences, for decades now, American media politicians and military brass have loudly blamed the Soviets for exporting the means and personnel of warfare to unstable lands. All the while, we're trying our own national damnedest not to be second best in the very same business. Now, the one thing that's important to point out here is that intelligence operations are generally not undertaken for just one reason. So the importance of these operations to gaining third world strategic materials for the United States is something that can't be discounted. But I think it's also important to observe in this context that the tightening of the reins, so to speak, the militarization abroad and the restrictions of civil liberties and increased police powers at home are both being generated in response to the terrorist threat. And not only Gaddafi, who I guess could sort of be the godfather of terrorism in modern terms, but also through Gaddafi and Turple and Wilson, the Red Brigades, the IRA, the Radical Palestinians, the Japanese Red Army, and so forth, are receiving aid from the CIA and from the U.S. National Security Establishment. And again, would toss out the question, is provocation a major goal? And this observer, for one, thinks it is, that provocation is a major goal of this funding of these terrorism-disposed nations, that basically the reaction to this terrorism is one of the things which the U.S. may be attempting to gain as a result of these operations. In other words, a vastly increased military presence abroad and a drastic limiting of the freedoms of the American people at home are two things that could be gained by the right by funding left terrorism, and that certainly appears to be at least one of the things involved with the Triple Wilson operation.
Now, to put what Dave just said in slightly different words and to look at it in a slightly different way, we can look at it as an equation. Okay, when you're trying to solve a problem of this sort, it has to stack up on both ends of the equal sign. We seem to have established, beyond a shadow of a doubt, at least as far as we're concerned, that there is a serious suspicion that Wilson and Turple are still involved in some shape or form with the CIA and still have at least some sort of agency approval of what they're doing, if they're not actively on the agency payroll, at the very least. Now, it's possible that one can try and finish this equation out by saying, as some of the right wingers in the CIA are saying, well, but that is necessary for national security to keep our hand in the Middle East and other troubled areas to prevent Soviet incursions into the oil producing countries and cutting off our national energy supply. Okay, well, this might be possibly acceptable. Obviously, it's a matter of political persuasion as to how you accept that argument. However, the part of that equation that does not stack up and that we have to examine also is, if this is the case, then why are Turple and Wilson being involved with people like, as Dave mentioned, like the Radical Palestinians, the Japanese Red Army, which, for goodness sakes, we don't have any real worry about a sudden left-wing coup that's going to take over Japan if we don't keep our hand in there, and other sorts. And, of course, people like Carlos the Jackal, who are involved in such things as the 1972 Munich massacre and the resultant horror, the terrible publicity for the PLO that came out of that, for all Palestinian organizations that came out of that, and the worldwide shock and revulsion against terrorism. Well, it begins to look, indeed, as Dave said, as if the act of provocation for the purpose of frightening people to make them more receptive to increased national security precautions could indeed be the reason. Okay, let's look at something else along that subject. Also remember, as we're talking about this next little bit, which is about Carlos the Jackal, that we have found an article in the New York Times, I believe it was, that revealed that, in fact, one of the other people involved in the 1972 Munich massacre and one of the most prominent members of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, one of Arafat's right-hand men, as a matter of fact, was a CIA asset, a man named Ali Hassan Salameh. today.
From the Wall Street Journal.
From the Wall Street Journal, thank you. We talked about that on One Step Beyond and Hard Rain. So bear that in mind when you're thinking about Carlos the Jackal in the 1972 Munich Massacre. We already know one of the Palestinians involved with the Munich Massacre was a top-level CIA asset. Okay, this is a Jack Anderson column from the San Francisco Chronicle for Tuesday, September 23rd, 1980. It's headlined, Carlos the Jackal. And again, think about the provocation aspect. Anderson writes, in the wilderness of mirrors that makes up the espionage game, the CIA once conspired to save the life of the world's most notorious terrorist, Carlos the Jackal. He picked up his animal nickname from the fictional assassin who almost nailed Charles de Gaulle in Frederick Forsyth's novel, The Day of the Jackal. But his real name was Ilich Ramirez Sanchez. He was the eldest son of an expatriate millionaire Colombian lawyer in Venezuela. This is his story, as pieced together by my associate Dale Van Atta from top-secret CIA and State Department documents. 1966. At 17, Carlos was trained in one of Fidel Castro's guerrilla camps. There he learned the terrorist art from General Viktor Siminov of the KGB. 1969. Carlos was expelled from Lumumba University in Moscow, where he had developed a friendship with a Palestinian commando, Mohammed Boudia. 1972. Carlos helped organize the massacre of Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics and the Japanese Red Army's indiscriminate machine gun slaughter at the Tel Aviv airport. June 1973. An Israeli hit team assassinated Carlos's old Moscow friend Boudia, and Carlos took over Palestinian terrorist operations in Europe. According to a top-secret document based on CIA internal files, Carlos was spared when the CIA warned the French government of the proposed execution. Why did the CIA save Carlos? Several sources in the agency suggested that it was a mafia-like professional concern that if Carlos were murdered, it would set off a wave of retaliatory killings by the Palestinians that would cause chaos in the murky world of international espionage. At any rate, Carlos was spared thanks to the CIA's intervention and lived to wreak his bloody handiwork. Now, a couple of things to think about in this article. First of all, the fact that Carlos, according to the CIA and State Department documents Jack Anderson cites, was expelled from Lumumba University, which was a revolutionary university in Moscow. Doesn't explain why, but he was expelled. Second of all, the logic that the CIA saved Carlos to prevent a wave of killings that would follow his killing is interesting. However, one has to ask, when you go back and look at that section that we read, it says an Israeli hit team assassinated Carlos's old Moscow friend Boudia, and Carlos took over Palestinian terrorist operations in Europe. Okay, the suggestion here is that Boudia was in fact in charge of Palestinian terrorist operations in Europe, and that his assassination led to Carlos's taking over. Well, one would have to ask if Boudia's assassination as head of European terrorist activities did not trigger a wave of killings, why Carlos's would. That's something to think about when you think about the CIA's logic. Okay, skipping down to finish off the article. He was captured by French police in June 1975, but managed to escape after killing an informant and two policemen. He masterminded the kidnapping of the OPEC oil ministers in December 1975. He helped engineer, in July 1976, the hijacking in Athens of an Air France plane, which wound up at Entebbe Airport, where the Israelis pulled off their daring rescue mission. And, of course, that Entebbe Airport was in the home court of Idi Amin of Uganda. And Idi Amin, as we already heard, was a personal buddy of Muammar Gaddafi, at whose request, Frank Turpel went to take information and help Idi Amin train his security forces, etc., etc.
Okay, and again, keep in mind that the statement by Frank Turpel that he trained Carlos, the intimation by Jack Anderson that Edwin Wilson was hiding out just down the hall from Carlos, and the late Kevin Mulcahy's testimony that he saw Turpel and Carlos at a party on a yacht in the Thames River. Okay, all very interesting in light of the fact that the CIA actually spared Carlos's life. And again, one question one has to ask here is is the CIA in some way supporting terrorism, and again, possibly as provocation, as a means of justifying U.S. militarization abroad and restriction of civil liberties among its citizenry, U.S. citizenry here at home. Well, last section we're going to deal with in our broadcast, we're going to take up the whole question of Muammar Gaddafi himself. There's so much discussion of Gaddafi, even at the present time, in connection with the mines, the mysterious mines that have been turning up in the Red Sea. There's a lot of speculation that a Libyan ship may have been involved with the laying of those mines. Now, in light of the significance of terrorism in modern life and its importance in our national policy at this time, and in light of Gaddafi's sort of role as the role at center stage of the terrorist theater, I think it's worth taking a look at just who Muammar Gaddafi is, where does he come from, and how is it that Turpin and Wilson of the CIA come to be involved with him. I'd like to read you a very short section from a book called The Control of Oil. That was authored by John Blair, copyrighted 1976 by Pantheon Books in a hardcover edition. And John Blair, in The Control of Oil, points out that Muammar Gaddafi received his military training from Great Britain and the United States, which is interesting in light of the fact that the U.S., the Soviet Union, rather, is generally portrayed as Gaddafi's sponsor. John Blair writes as follows in The Control of Oil. On September 1st, 1969, the constitutional monarchy of King Idris was overthrown by a group of Libyan army officers. The administration of the government was assumed by a revolutionary command council headed by Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi, who prior to the coup had been a captain in the Libyan army. Graduating from the University of Libya in 1963 and the Royal Military Academy in 1965, he had taken advanced military training in both Great Britain and the United States. So Gaddafi's senior military training comes from Britain and the U.S. An interesting bit of detail in light of the fact, again, that we're always handed Gaddafi the Red, okay? Gaddafi the Soviet puppet. Now, in the last Radio Free America broadcast that we did about Reinhard Galen and his organization, we touched on the origin of Gaddafi's secret service. Now, basically, reviewing very briefly, Reinhard Galen was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front in World War II. After the war, he jumped to the CIA with his entire organization, including thousands of SS and Gestapo men. They became, for all intents and purposes, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, and then they became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and finally the West German intelligence service, which they are to this day. Now, one of the things that we looked at, one of the machinations of the so-called Galen organization, which again was functioning as part of the CIA for a long time, including brought thousands of Nazi war criminals into our intelligence system, basically, in the early 50s, when Gamal Nasser of Egypt, president of Egypt, was putting together his general staff and also his intelligence service, he basically turned to Alan Dulles of the CIA for help. And because of the CIA's relationship with Israel, Dulles did not feel that sending any American agents in to put together the Egyptian Secret Service would be a good idea. So what he did was he had Reinhard Galen put together a team to, again, build Nasser's intelligence service, okay? Now, what Galen did, and again, working under CIA auspices here, he put together a group of top Nazi war criminals, most of them affiliated with Hitler's so-called final solution to the Jewish problem, with his extermination of the Jews. And they went and basically put together the Egyptian Secret Service, and also team of, basically helped put together the Egyptian General Staff as well. Now, this group of war criminals were, in fact, war criminals. They were some of the most heinous names to come out of the Third Reich, including, according to one account, Adolf Eichmann himself. Now, this group was headed up by a man named Otto Skorzeny. Now, Skorzeny was a colonel in the SS and one of the key members of not only Hitler's military command, but also a very, very prominent CIA agent after the war. He was worked very closely with Galen during the closing days of the Third Reich, and also became one of the most important CIA functionaries in the 1950s. Now, Otto Skorzeny, again, a colonel in the SS, the man who rescued Mussolini, took this group of Nazi war criminals, built the Egyptian Secret Service, and then after Gaddafi overthrew King Idris, or King Idris, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, of Libya, Gaddafi turned to Nasser, Gaddafi and Nasser were quite close. Interesting in light of the fact that Nasser was a German spy during World War II. But Gaddafi and Nasser were close, and Gaddafi requested that Nasser place the German experts at his disposal, which Nasser did. And so then the same Skorzeny-led team of Nazi war criminals, which had put together the Egyptian Secret Service for Nasser, put together Gaddafi's intelligence service as well. That information from a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning. Hardcover edition by Lyle Stewart. Okay, that's where that information came from. So Otto Skorzeny and his group of Nazi war criminals also put together the Egyptian, the Libyan intelligence service, as they did the Egyptian, and again, while working under the sponsorship of the CIA. Now, in light of the Galen origins of Gaddafi's Secret Service, it's not as surprising as we might have seen to find Turple and Wilson and the CIA hooked up with Gaddafi. And another thing we looked at in connection with the Galen broadcast, the Galen Radio Free America broadcast, was a fellow by the name of Otto von Bolschwing. Now, von Bolschwing was Adolf Eichmann's superior during Hitler's extermination of the Jews. After the war, he became head of Galen's North American operation, and the reporter who first broke this story was a San Jose Mercury reporter named Pete Carey. Now, he came across von Bolschwing while following the trail of Frank Turple. Okay, so again, yet another Galen link to the Turple Wilson group, and again, keep in mind the fact that Pete Carey came across von Bolschwing while following Frank Turple's trail here in the Silicon Valley, and keep in mind the fact that Otto Skorzeny and his group of Galen-sponsored Nazi war criminals put together the Egyptian Secret Service, because the Gaddafi-Skorzeny Association is one that we find later on as well.
And the place where we find it is in a group called the Paladin Group, which is a group that is part of a larger organization called the Internacional Fascista, which we're going to hear a little bit about here. That specifically Paladin is what we're going to be talking about. This is from the book The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Kruger, K-R-U-G-E-R. It was published in 1980 by Dial Press. Excellent book. To begin with, they're talking about Coru, C-O-R-U, which is a a Cuban exile group that, along with DINA, D-I-N-A, the Chilean secret police, was implicated in the aforementioned 1976 murder of Orlando Letelier, in which Edwin Wilson's name has been bandied about also. So that's Coru, a Cuban exile group, very right-wing, involved in numerous terrorist activities and bombings and murders. Reading from Kruger's book, the common denominator in Coru, as well as Internacional Fascista, a combine of anti-communist extremist organizations chartered at an October 1976 meeting in Rome, attended by Coru representatives, appears to have been the CIA, or at least a faction thereof. Coru's headquarters are in Miami. Originally, it was sustained by tight collaboration with the CIA and the Chilean junta's secret police. According to the Cuban former CIA agent Manuel Darmas, the CIA coordinated DINA's acts with Coru's and supplied the latter with funds, advisors, and explosives. The head of DINA's Miami-based force was reportedly Eduardo Sepulveda, the Chilean attaché in Miami and a top dog in DINA. Internacional Fascista is the outgrowth of many years of planning in Madrid by the late Nazi Otto Skorzeny, who in the 50s had worked for the CIA. Okay, follows a description of many of the different fascist groups that are members of the Internacional Fascista, Spanish and South American and Italian groups. Anyway, skipping on down, SS Colonel Skorzeny was the kingpin of the Paladin mercenary group until his death in 1975. Dr. Gerhard Hartmut von Schubert, formerly of Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry, was its operating manager. Headquartered in Albufeira, Spain, its actual nerve centers were Skorzeny's export-import offices and cover firm, MC, located at a Madrid address shared with a front for the Spanish intelligence agency, SCOE, under Colonel Eduardo Blanco, and also an office of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. Skipping on down, a melange of former OAS and SAC figures, those are the OAS is the Secret Army Organization of France, and the SAC is a group of French intelligence and gangster groups. A melange of former OAS and SAC figures and West German rightist activists and mercenaries, Paladin joined terrorist actions in Europe, Africa, Latin America, and even Southeast Asia. Along with Italian fascists, Paladin is responsible for the 17th of December 1973 bombing of Rome's Fiumicino airport, which claimed 32 lives. On behalf of the Spanish government, Paladin kidnapped and murdered leaders of the Basque ETA, and in 1974-76 engineered some 50 bombings in Basque country. Paladin's bankrollers included Skorzeny's weapons empire and Libyan head of state Muammar Gaddafi. Okay, skipping down one last part, since Paladin is such an important part of Internacional Fascista, and because the Internacional Fascista is receiving at least some of its funding from Muammar Gaddafi, here's one last brief segment. Internacional Fascista was a crucial first step toward fulfilling the dream not only of Skorzeny, but also of his close friends in Madrid exile, José López Rega, Juan Perón's gray eminence, and Prince Justo Valerio Borghese, the Italian fascist money man who had been rescued from execution at the hands of the World War II Italian resistance by future CIA counterintelligence whiz James J. Angleton. They, and other Nazi and fascist powers throughout Europe and Latin America, envisioned a new world order built on a fascist iron circle linking Buenos Aires, Santiago, Lima, La Paz, Brasilia, and Montevideo. So, what we have here in this segment, these series of segments actually strung together out of the Great Heroin Coup, is we have the Internacional Fascista, a combine of fascist groups looking forward to creating a fascist iron circle, a type of Fourth Reich, being led to a large extent by Otto Skorzeny. Otto Skorzeny, a former CIA agent. We're seeing Internacional Fascista's offices in CIA headquarters. We're seeing the Paladin Group, a mercenary group that's part of the Internacional Fascista, being financed by Skorzeny's weapons empire, part of which was acquired during his time as a CIA operative, and Muammar Gaddafi. So the connection between the CIA, Muammar Gaddafi, and the International Fascista Organization is drawn a little tighter.
And again, keep in mind the Galen origins of Gaddafi's intelligence service and Skorzeny's role in putting that thing together and his association with Gaddafi and the Paladin mercenary group.
I should just... And seven, Los Altos Hills.
Indeed, and... keep in mind also that the Nazis, of course, seized dictatorial powers in Germany through the use of provocation. Again, keep in mind Gaddafi's role as sort of the godfather of international terrorism. Well, in terms of where Gaddafi's real allegiances lie, it's worth noting that many people in the Middle East, many observers, have felt that Gaddafi was actually CIA. And keep in mind that in Gung Ho, we looked at statements by Ed Charles and Colonel Fletcher Prouty that the CIA regarded Gaddafi as an asset. Returning again to the book Libyan Sandstorm by John Cooley. Long before two American CIA operatives, Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson, made their 1976 commercial deal with Gaddafi to sell Libya their U.S. intelligence expertise, contacts, and gimmickry, it appeared to Arabs in the Middle East that Gaddafi had indeed made a pact with the devil, unquote, and was enjoying American CIA protection. Gaddafi, a Lebanese editor friendly with many of the Western correspondents based in Beirut, used to comment, is an American agent. He must be on the American payroll. How else can you explain some of his actions? Many Arabs shared this view. And a little later, second, and what was equally or even more evident from the start, was what amounted to CIA protection of Gaddafi's regime and person. First to learn to their grief of this protection were two Libyan colonels, Adam al-Hawaz, H-A-W-A-Z, and Musa Ahmed, A-H-M-E-D, the defense and interior ministers in Gaddafi's first government formed in September of 1969. Neither man was part of the inner circle, the first and second cells of revolutionaries who originally planned the coup. Both had been brought into the RCC fold at the last minute. The RCC is the elite group of officers who represent the core of Gaddafi's revolutionary regime. Both were Syrianations with good army contacts. Above all, both were friendly with the British and Americans. Their explanations of Gaddafi's revolution to Westerners and to Nasser's envoy, Muhammad Haikal, were reassuring, and it helped to sell a coup to London and Washington and win assurances of non-intervention and recognition from those two key Western capitals. Before the end of September 1969, Gaddafi, Jalloud, and the other 10 RCC members had moved out of their first headquarters in the broadcasting station to the Azizia barracks near the gates of Tripoli for greater protection. Soon it became apparent that all was not well in the RCC. There was quarreling over priorities, jobs, and other matters. Precisely what happened with Ahmed and Hawaz may never be known. It is clear that Gaddafi, inclined to be overcautious to the point of paranoia about people he didn't completely trust, knew, or thought he knew, that some kind of conspiracy was brewing among the outsiders, unquote. Men like Ahmed and Hawaz, who had operated on the fringes of the RCC, and who now controlled the security forces in the Defense and Interior Ministries. At some point in early December of 1969, either the CIA station chief himself or another U.S. agent operating under military or corporate cover warned Gaddafi that there was indeed a conspiracy brewing against him and that his least trustworthy associates were Ahmed and Hawaz, the two pro-Western senior officers. So here we have indications that the CIA at least one occasion had saved Gaddafi's life, as they had Carlos the Jackal's. And indeed, keep in mind the Charles and Prouty statements that Gaddafi is an asset and all the other information we've given you.
Okay, getting down towards the wrap-up of the information section with just a couple of things left to talk about. Lest you think that all these activities only rebound in the Middle East and far-off distant places like that, and lest you think that all of these things took place 5, 6, 7 years ago, just like to point one thing out real quickly that we ran across in a book called Endless Enemies by Jonathan Quitney, who is a Wall Street Journal reporter. It's a very good book, by the way. It's full of all kinds of nifty things. It's copyrighted 1984. It's published by Congdon and Weed Incorporated in New York. The segment that I'm going to read, which is rather short, alludes to the Grenada invasion, which most of you out there probably remember. Just to real quickly give you the background on it, the president in Grenada for many years prior to the Grenadian invasion, the head of the country was a man named Maurice Bishop, head of the New Jewel political party, the New Jewel movement, and a socialist, a friend of Fidel Castro's, and still a tremendously popular man in Grenada, very popular man. Okay, now what happened is that the coup started, Bernard Cord and General T. Hudson Austin, Bernard Cord had been a cabinet member, and T. Hudson Austin apparently started the coup. Within the first days of the coup, Maurice Bishop, the very popular head of state, was killed by the military. Then the United States used the safety of the American students in the medical school there as an excuse to go into Grenada and prevent the revolution, or prevent the overthrow, as the case may be, and restore a more favorable government, favorable to the United States. Now, one of the points that Quitney makes is that if the government had invaded Grenada a week or two before, it would have been just as socialist, if not more so, but that they would have found a much less popular reception, because Maurice Bishop was a very, very well-loved public figure. Bear in mind also that, although we don't really have time to go into it tonight, that there are numerous strange intelligence ties to the Grenada Medical School that we've outlined on back numbers of One Step Beyond Hard Rain, which we don't have time to talk about tonight. Anyway, reading from Jonathan Quitney's book, Endless Enemies. The intriguing thing about the Cord coup, as one sees it from the facts now available, is that the only outsiders who stood to benefit from overthrowing Bishop were not the Cubans or Russians, but the policymakers in Washington. With U.S. military efforts in Central America and Lebanon in real trouble, and the president planning to run for re-election, the U.S. governing team needed a victory to justify its whole foreign policy attitude. Is it possible that Washington, acting perhaps through some agent provocateur, catalyzed the October coup on Grenada, paving the way for our intervention? Could Cord himself, who was quickly captured by the U.S. but not made available for public questioning, have been in U.S. pay? There is no evidence for saying so, except for the circumstances cited here, and the fact that such a scheme would have been no more exotic than others we have tried in the Congo, in Vietnam, in Iran, in Guatemala, in Cuba itself, and in other places. All the stranger, then, is the presence of one-time CIA operative and international bête noir, Frank Turple, on Grenada right up to the time of the coup, when he returned to his haunts in the Middle East. We can only hope that in years to come, some logical explanation will be forthcoming for why Bernard Kaur did what he did.
So again, Frank Turple's name cropping up once again in the context of provocation, the overthrow of the Maurice Bishop government, its replacement with ostensibly a more militant left-wing government, which served as the justification for the U.S. invasion of Grenada. Okay, very quickly, President Reagan has been making many statements about how he does not recognize Soviet hegemony over Eastern Europe, and he referred to Soviet hegemony in Poland and other places, and I thought in that context it might be good to wind up the broadcast here with some information concerning Turple and Wilson and some of their associates' activities in Poland, or in around Poland, concerned with, of course, arms trafficking. Following articles from the news from Newsweek, the issue of April 23rd, 1984. There's an article here entitled, "A Trail of U.S. Guns to Poland." It was a gun-running operation with a twist. Earlier this year, U.S. customs agents seized a shipment of 500 Connecticut-made Ruger automatic rifles, electronic torture devices, and a specially armed Cadillac worthy of James Bond, all headed for Polish officials in Warsaw. Federal agents had never before encountered anyone trying to smuggle arms to the Soviet bloc, where guns are not exactly in short supply. The tale grew stranger still. Authorities learned that the two New York men arrested for the attempted smuggling, Solomon Schwartz and Leonard Berg, also had dealings with officials of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency. Investigators are still trying to solve a case that appeared to lead deep into the murky fellowship of international arms merchants. Newsweek has learned that a grand jury has subpoenaed Leon Lisbona, a security expert and associate of Frank Turple, the former CIA employee who has been charged with providing arms and torture equipment to Muammar Gaddafi and Idi Amin, among others. Lisbona, who runs an electronics retail store on Madison Avenue, has not been charged and refused to respond to inquiries by reporters. But federal authorities believe that he and another Turple friend, Gary Corkle,